Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to cover Job chapter 26, verses 1 through 14. I will entitle this chapter, Job Replies to Bildad. God's Majesty is Unsearchable. Now, our context is this. In our last chapter, Bildad has spoken his last little speech to Job. He has said nothing new. He basically says, man cannot be righteous. God is holy. He's awesome. Man is a maggot. He's a worm. And of course, the implication was is that Job was a maggot and a worm for trying to pretend that he had not committed some kind of horrible sin, which would justify God's calamities poured out on Job's head. And Job, of course, is responding by saying, I didn't do anything to deserve this. Now, in chapter 26, when Job replies, God's majesty is unsearchable, he's actually agreeing with Bildad, because that's not what his argument is. He's not trying to deny God's majesty, his power, his omniscience, his inexpressible glory. He's just trying to find out why he's being punished for something he didn't do. So Bildad has completely missed the point, and Job is now responding to Bildad. So we start with Job 26, verses 1 through 4. Then Job responded, i.e. to Bildad, what a help you are to the weak. Now, this is obvious sarcasm. Job says, have you saved the arm without strength? In other words, he's referring to himself. He's the arm without strength because he's so weak. Have you saved me, Bildad? What counsel you have given to one without wisdom? Job saying, look, I'm stupid. You keep saying I'm stupid. I know you've really helped me out, given me a lot of wise counsel. What helpful insight, Job continues, you have abundantly provided. Again, he's just dripping with sarcasm. To whom have you uttered words, and whose spirit was expressed through you? Now, verse 2, Job says, what a help you are to the weak, Bildad. I interpreted that verse in advance and said that Job is referring to himself. I'm weak, and what a help you are to me. But there's some other options. John Gill suggests that, what a help you are to the weak, that Job is being sarcastic and saying, oh, Bildad, you think you're helping God out. He's a weak God, and he needs your help. So that's why you're telling us in the previous chapter what a great God is and what a maggot and what a worm man is. I don't think that's what Job meant, although it is possible. What a help you are to the weak. John Gill suggests that maybe that's referring to the weak cause that Bildad has. Job is saying, oh, you really helped your weak case out there, Bildad, with your last six verses of nonsense. Or another option, what a help you are to the weak, to your two dumb friends, Eliphaz and Zophar. Or what about this? Another option Gill comes up with, what a help you are to the weak, to yourself, Bildad. You're really helping yourself out with these stupid arguments. Now, all of those are possible, but I think it's just as easy as John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown say that Bildad is referring to Job. What a help you are to me, the weak. And so then Job said, Bildad, have you saved the arm without strength, my arm? Have you given counsel to me who is without wisdom? And of course, those are rhetorical questions. The answer is no, no, you haven't. What helpful insight you have provided, sarcasm. Now, verse 4, to whom have you uttered words? Now, what does that mean? Well, it means this. Job knows as much about God as Bildad did. So what he's saying is, who do you think you're talking to, a spiritual ignoramus? To whom have you uttered words? To me, Job, and I'm not as stupid as you think I am. I know just as much about God as you do. You keep saying God is majestic and powerful. Well, I'm going to tell you the same thing. His majesty is unsearchable right here in chapter 26. In verse 4, Job says, whose spirit was expressed through you, Bildad? Here's some options as to what Job means there. John Gill says it could be referring to God's spirit. In other words, Job is saying, Bildad, are you really dumb enough to think God was speaking through you? Whose spirit was speaking through you? God's spirit? Come on. God's not as dumb as you are, Bildad. I think that's probably the correct interpretation there. Or here's another option from Gill. Whose spirit was expressed to you? Whose spirit has been refreshed and revived by you? It certainly wasn't mine, Job's. Well, that would mean that expressed would have to have the idea of refreshed and revived, and I don't know the Hebrew well enough to know whether that's legitimate or not. Here's another option that Gill mentions, and whose spirit was expressed through you? Eliphaz's? In other words, are you just putting words in Eliphaz's mouth? Are you giving me the gist of Eliphaz's complaint? I don't think so. I think it's talking about God's spirit. Whose spirit was expressed through you? You think you're speaking for God? You know it all, Bildad? Are you really dumb enough to think that God was really speaking through you? We go down to Job 26, verse 5. The departed spirits tremble beneath the waters and all that inhabit them. Now, we'll talk about who these spirits might be in a minute, but whoever they are, they're trembling. The NIV Study Bible says they're either trembling from suffering or they're trembling before God's majesty. Now, Job is challenging Bildad here. He knows that Bildad, in the last chapter, those 6 verses, Bildad went far in describing God's awesome power, but he did go far enough, and so Job's going to outdo him. He's going to say, I believe, just like you do, Bildad, that God is a great God. Now, who are these spirits beneath the waters? Well, let's look at some other translations. The NIV has the dead are in deep anguish, those beneath the waters and all that live in them. So the NIV has the departed spirits are dead spirits. The KJV doesn't have the spirits as being people, but the KJV says dead things are formed under the waters. Adam Clark doesn't like that translation of the King James. He said, this verse as it stands in our version, i.e. the King James Version, this verse seems to convey no meaning, and the Hebrew is obscure. Ha-rephaim, the rephaim, certainly means not dead things, nor can there be any propriety in saying that dead things, or things without life, are formed under the waters, for such things are formed everywhere in the earth and under the earth as well as under the waters. So, let's knock out the KJV, dead things. Let's go with departed spirits. Got another option, though. The Septuagint translation says, behold, the giants, not dead people, but giants, and those who dwell with them groan from under the waters. Adam Clark says that doesn't make any sense either, and I tend to agree with him. So we're going to take this as departed spirits under the waters are trembling. Now, what is the allusion to? What does it mean, dead spirits under the water? Well, here's the first option. Adam Clark says that this is an allusion to the destruction of the earth by Noah's flood. Before Noah's flood, in Genesis 6:4, we read about the Nephilim. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Now, this is the famous passage. People debate whether demons actually entered and took human form, like succubi, and had sex with human women. And I'm not going to get into that because I don't believe that. But the idea is you got these bad people, these giants, the Nephilim, who were on the earth, and Noah's flood wiped them out in the next chapter, Genesis 7, the flood came, Genesis 7 and following. And so the idea, according to this view, is that it's talking about the departed spirits, the Nephilim trembled beneath the waters of Noah's flood. Jameson Fawcett Brown says, here's option number 2, that the departed spirits under the waters are the souls of dead people in general. The place of the dead is just represented as being under the waters, and I personally think that's the best way to describe it. I guess dead people ended up in the grave, but I guess they can end up under the water too, especially after Noah's flood. And the whole ancient world had a knowledge of the worldwide flood, because the flood stories are in every ancient culture. So that could very well be what Job is referring to here. Dead people who got flooded by the universal flood beneath the waters. And, of course, the other option is who the departed spirits are. I've already mentioned is the King James translation, non-human things, T-H-I-N-G-S, things. For example, like grain, sea plants, metals and minerals, sea monsters, whatever is under the water. And I don't think that's a good, I agree with Adam Clark, I don't think that's a good explanation. All right, so we got dead people trembling under the waters and all that inhabit the waters. So you got dead people under two things. They're under the water and all those things that are in the water. That is easiest to understand as marine life. Those are the things that are in the water. I came up with this idea, which is probably no good, that the departed spirits are under the waters and all of the other departed spirits that are under the water, sort of to intensify the fact that the dead spirits are deluged with a monstrously big flood. And the whole point of this verse is to show how great God is and how pathetic dead men are. God is greater than people. You see, Job is not trying to say he's any god or demigod. He's just trying to say, I didn't do a sin big enough to suffer what I'm suffering. We go now to Job 26, verse 6. Job continues, naked is Sheol before him, and Abaddon has no covering. Sheol, of course, is the Hebrew word for death or grave. And since the grave is naked, that means God looks down and sees everybody in the grave. And he says, I'm bigger than you are because you're dead in the grave and I'm up here in heaven. That fits right in with Job's theme. He's trying to show, hey, Bildad, I agree with you. God's a great God. I'm not trying to take him off his throne. And the last part of verse 6 says, Abaddon has no covering. Abaddon in the NIV is translated as destruction, as the NIV Study Bible and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say. Abaddon means the place where souls perish or come to ruin. So basically, Sheol is the same place as Abaddon. Sheol just means death. Abaddon means you're destroyed in the grave. Here's what Easton says about Abaddon. Destruction. It means destruction. The Hebrew name is equivalent to the Greek Apollyon, i.e. destroyer, which is mentioned in Revelation 9:11, the angel of the bottomless pit. The Hebrew word is rendered destruction in Job 28:22, Job 31:12, Job 26:6, Proverbs 15:11, Proverbs 27:20. So it's quite common in the Old Testament. We may regard, says Easton, we may regard this word as a personification of the idea of destruction, or as Sheol, the realm of the dead. So basically it means where people are dead. And this place, Abaddon, where people are destroyed, has no covering. That means God can look down at it and he knows exactly who's down there. They're not hiding from him. God is bigger than mankind. Even in the lowest and darkest regions of creation, God still sees everything. So we go now to Job 26, verses 7 through 10. He, that's God, stretches the northern skies over empty space. He hangs the earth on nothing. He wraps up the waters in his clouds, yet the clouds do not burst beneath their weight. He obscures the view of his throne, spreading his cloud over it. He laid out the horizon on the surface of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. Sounds like a thunderstorm at the beach. It's a great description, actually. Why does he mention the northern skies? Why does God stretch the northern skies over empty space? And again, the whole purpose of this is to show God's majesty as opposed to our mankind's pitiful, puny, worm-like, maggot-like state. Why does Job mention the northern skies? Well, here's a couple of possible reasons. The Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary says that the northern skies were believed to be the highest part of the earth. Isaiah 14:13, but you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the Mount of Assembly in the recesses of the north. That's Isaiah, or God, talking to the king of Babylon. So the king of Babylon says, I'm going to sit in a mountain where everybody assembles in the recesses of the north. The idea, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, is the north is where everything is high. John Gill has a more mundane explanation of that. He says the northern hemisphere was the best known hemisphere in the time of Job. Now remember, Job was living in the northern hemisphere. Now Job may have some knowledge of the southern hemisphere, but his knowledge of the northern hemisphere was greater. We read in Job 9:9, Job says this, he, God, makes the stars, the Bear, Orion, the Pleiades. Those are all northern constellations. And he also makes the constellations of the southern sky. Job did not name those constellations by name. Adam Clark, for some reason, says Job could have known nothing of the southern hemisphere. I don't know why. I guess because he never sees it, because he's up in the north. Maybe he just states as a matter of faith, I know God made the constellations of the southern sky, whatever they might be. So Job mentions the earth hanging in the air, in space, clouds wrapped up in water. They're so big and heavy and black, but they don't burst. The clouds obscure the view of his throne, because his throne's up in heaven, and we have to look up through the clouds to see his throne. In verse 10, God lays out the horizon on the surface of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. Verse 10 is literally, he laid out the circle on the surface of the waters. That tells us that Job believed that the earth was round and not flat. It is a myth that people in the Middle Ages believed that the earth was flat. They did not. The Greeks knew the earth was round. They did. Actually, the Greeks measured the circumference of the earth. Christopher Columbus believed the earth was round. That's why he was sailing west to get to Japan. He was totally wrong about how big the earth was, but he was right about it being round. So verse 10, God lays out the circle of the earth on the surface of the waters. Very descriptive. At the boundary between light and darkness, of course, that's when the sun comes up and you see the horizon. That's what the horizon is, actually. It's actually the boundary between the sky and the earth. But if you say the boundary between light and darkness, now you're talking about the boundary between light and day as the sun comes up over the horizon. We go now to Job 26, verses 11 through 14. Job continues, the pillars of heaven tremble and are amazed at his rebuke. He quieted the sea with his power, and by his understanding he shattered Rahab. By his breath the heavens are cleared. His hand has pierced the fleeing serpent. Behold, these are the fringes of his ways. And how faint a word we hear of him, but his mighty thunder, who could understand? Now, what are the pillars of heaven in verse 11? The pillars of heaven tremble. two possibilities. It could be just the air that holds up heaven. A pillar is something that holds up an edifice. And so the idea is something's got to hold the sky up. Something's got to hold heaven up. And it could be the air right beneath the heaven where God lives, the atmosphere, the lower part of the heavens. It seems to tremble when there's thunder and lightning. The pillars of heaven tremble. But I don't think that's what it is. That's Gill's idea. I believe it's talking about the mountains, as Gill suggests, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown agrees with. The mountains of heaven. Because if you look at mountains, they look like pillars holding heaven up. If you're in a distance looking at a couple of mountains, they're holding heaven up, and they tremble. Why do they tremble? Well, earthquakes, thunderstorms on the mountains. They're amazed at his rebuke. That would be thunder, I'm sure. Verse 12, God quieted the sea with his power. KJV has he divideth the sea with his power. Many believe that's an allusion to the parting of the Red Sea. The NIV has he churned up the sea with his power, which of course is exactly the opposite of quieting the sea with his power. John Gill explains that. He says that the Hebrew word used here is used in opposite senses. Now, that is a strange phenomenon. I remember in China, my wife and I were moaning and groaning about trying to learn that crazy language. And I said, now look at this word. I found several words in the dictionary. I said, here's the definition. It had definitions, two definitions, each of which were exactly diametrically opposed to the other. And I said, is it any wonder that nobody can learn this language? Well, apparently Hebrew's got the same thing, according to John Gill. The word is used in Psalm 65:7, God stills the roaring of the seas, the roaring of the waves and the tumult of the peoples. He stills the seas. Here it's, he churns up, according to the NIV translation, he churns up the sea. Doesn't matter whether he quiets the sea or churns it up. He controls it. Now let's look at Rahab. And by God's understanding, God shattered Rahab. Who or what is Rahab? A couple of options. Rahab could be a poetic name for Egypt, as Gill and Clark point out. Easton's dictionary says, Rahab means insolence or pride, a poetical name applied to Egypt in several verses in the Old Testament. The proud one. Okay, so Egypt is the proud one. The Hebrew actually means proud. But Rahab can also mean a sea monster. As the NIV Study Bible points out, Rahab is a name used to symbolize the sea, because a mythical sea monster named Rahab lived in the sea. So Rahab could stand for the monster in the sea or can stand for the sea itself by extension. Now this monster was associated with Baal worship. The Israelites didn't actually believe in the monster, but they knew about him because people talked about him. Kind of like people in my home county talk about the lizard man. We know he doesn't exist, but we like to talk about him. At least we think he doesn't exist. Now the NIV Study Bible says Rahab is used in multiple ways to symbolize outward hostility towards God's people. So whether it's Egypt is hostile to God's people, or whether it's just hostility against God's people in general, God is in control of the sea, so he's in control of those who are hostile to Israel. And again, this is assuming that Job is written somewhere around the time of the formation of Israel. The KJV here has the proud. And by his understanding, God shattered the proud, in which case you're not talking about a mythical monster. So the commentators disagree on that, but we got the general idea is God is bigger than the sea, because the sea is opposed to Israel or opposed to his people, and God controls the sea. Verse 13, by his breath the heavens are cleared. That gets rid of all the clouds. Whoosh, one puff, and there go all the clouds. The NIV has it, the skies become fair. And then at the end of verse 13, Job says that God's hand has pierced the fleeing serpent. Now, the fleeing serpent is interesting because the Hebrew there is Leviathan. The Holman Christian Study Bible note just puts it right there in the margin, Leviathan. The NIV has the gliding serpent. The NASB has the fleeing serpent. I don't know why you just wouldn't put Leviathan in the translation. Leviathan, of course, is the famous name that the English philosopher, the materialist atheist philosopher Hobbes, said about government that got out of control. It was like a Leviathan, and so that word is stuck, has become a part of the English language. Well, who was Leviathan? Well, the NIV Study Bible tells us ancient Middle Eastern stories told of the sea monster Rahab. We've already talked about Rahab. And the gliding serpent Leviathan. In the Bible, these monsters, Rahab and Leviathan, poetically symbolize the forces of nature that wreak havoc on the earth. The verse declares that God is more powerful than the wildest force nature can unleash. And that's the long and short of it right there. Let's look at what Easton says about Leviathan, a transliterated Hebrew word, Leviathan, meaning twisted or coiled. So that's why the serpent is, it's a gliding, twisted, coiled serpent. In Job 3:8, and in the margin of the King James, Leviathan denotes the dragon, which, according to Eastern tradition, is an enemy of light. The dragon curled itself around the sun during an eclipse and shut the sun down. The crocodile is meant in Psalm 104. Leviathan denotes any large animal that moves by writhing or wriggling the body, the whale, the monsters of the deep. The word is also used figuratively for a cruel enemy, as some think the Egyptian host crushed by the divine power and cast on the shores of the Dead Sea. As used in Isaiah 27:1, Leviathan the piercing or swift serpent, even Leviathan that crooked or winding serpent. Depends on your translation. So, let's just take Leviathan as the dragon, a serpent that wraps itself around the sun. Rahab is a sea monster. Rahab stands for either Egypt or pride. God's over all that. By his hands he pierces. I guess he has an instrument in his hand to pierce the fleeing Leviathan serpent. Kills it. Verse 14, behold, these are the fringes of his ways. In other words, as loud as the thunder is, and as dramatic as it is to stab a fleeing Leviathan, and as dramatic as it is to shatter Rahab, the sea monster, that's just a little tiny edge of what God is, what he's doing. As the NIV puts it, these are but the outer fringe of God's works. How faint a word we hear of him. The shattering of Rahab, the piercing of the fleeing serpent, the thunder. Well, it mentions the thunder here in verse 14. His mighty thunder, who can understand? We hear his thunder. We see all of his great works. But it's just a little tiny aspect of what God is, how powerful he is. The NIV has, how faint the whisper. How faint the whisper of his ways. How faint a word we hear of him. This is similar to what Job said in Job 4, verse 12. A word was brought to me in secret. My ears caught a whisper of it. As loud as thunder is, it is just faint compared to all that we could hear from God. As Ellicott says, quote, we can only hear the faintest whisper of his glory and cannot understand or endure the full-toned thunder of his majesty. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished. Job chapter 26, verses 1 through 14. We are now ready to turn in our next audio to Job chapter 27, verses 1 through 23. We will entitle that chapter, Job Continues, I Will Maintain My Integrity, because Job still has not been beaten down by his false friends yet. And so this might be a little encouraging. So I hope you stay tuned for this next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.